Chapter 11. The Feast. The day of our patroness falls in the fading of winter. Then do we make merry. The journeymen perform the sword dance in procession, leaping and fantastic. The masters light the ruined chapel in the grand court with 1,000 perfumed candles, and we ready our feast. In the guild, the annual observance is counted as lofty, in which a journeyman is elevated to mastership, lesser, in which one apprentice at least is created journeyman, or least, in which no elevation takes place. Since no journeyman rose to mastership in the year in which I was made a journeyman, which is not to be wondered at, since such occasions are rarer than the decades, the ceremony of my masking was a lesser feast. Even so, weeks were spent in preparation. I have heard it said that no less than 135 guilds have members laboring within the citadel walls. Of these, some, as we have seen among the curators, are too few to keep their patron's feast in the chapel, but must join their brothers in the city. Those more numerous celebrate with such pomp as they may to raise the esteem in which they are held. Of this kind are the soldiers upon Hadrian's Day, the matroses on Barbara's, the witches on Mag's, and many others. By pageantry and wonders, and freely given food and drink, they seek to have as many as may be from outside their guilds attend their ceremonies. Not so is it among the torturers. No one from without the guild has dined with us at Holy Catherine's feast for more than 300 years, when a lieutenant of the guard, so it is said, dared to come for a wager. There are many idle tales of what befell him, as that we made him seat himself at our table upon a chair of glowing iron. None of them are true. By the lore of our guild, he was made welcome and well-feasted. But because we did not, over our meat and Catherine cake, talk of the pain we had inflicted, or devise new modes of torment, or curse those whose flesh we had torn for dying too soon, he grew ever more anxious, imagining that we sought to lull his fears so we might entrap him subsequently. Thus thinking, he ate little and drank much, and, returning to his own quarters, fell and struck his head in such a way that he evermore upon occasion lost his wits and suffered great pain. In time he put the muzzle of his own weapon into his mouth, but it was none of our doing. None but torturers, then, come to the chapel on Holy Catherine's Day. Yet each year, knowing we are watched from high windows, we prepare, as do all the rest, and more grandly. Outside the chapel, our wines burn like gems in the light of 100 flambeaux. Our beeves steam and wallow in ponds of gravy, rolling baked lemon eyes. Capybaras and agoutis, posed in the stances of life, and bearing fur in which toasted coconut mingles with their own flayed skin, clamber on logs of ham, and scale boulders of new baked bread. Our masters, of whom when I was made journeyman there were only two, arrive in sedan chairs whose curtains are woven of blossoms, and tread carpets patterned of colored sands, carpets telling of the traditions of the guild and laid grain by the journeymen in days of toil, and destroyed at once by the feet of the masters. Within the chapel wait a great spiked wheel, a maid, and a sword. That wheel I knew well, for as an apprentice I had several times assisted in setting it up and taking it down. It was stored in the topmost part of the tower, just under the gun room, when it was not in use. The sword, though it seemed a true headsman's blade from a pace or two away, was no more than a wooden baton, provided with an old hilt and brightened with tinsel. Of the maid I can tell you nothing. When I was very young, I did not even wonder about her. Those are the earliest feasts I can remember. When I was a little older, and Gildas, who was long since a journeyman at the time of which I write, was captain of apprentices, I thought her perhaps one of the witches. When I grew a year older, I knew such disrespect would not be tolerated. Perhaps she was a servant from some remote part of the citadel. Perhaps she was a resident of the city, who for gain, or because of some old connection with our guild, consented to play the part. I do not know. I only know that each feast found her in her place, and so far as I could judge, unchanged. She was tall and slender, though not so tall nor so slender as Thecla, dark of complexion, dark of eye, raven of hair. Hers was such a face as I have never seen elsewhere, like a pool of pure water found in the midst of a wood. She stood between the wheel and the sword, while Master Palaemon, as the older of our masters, told us of the founding of the guild, and of our precursors in the years before the ice came. This part was different each year, as his scholarship decided. Silent she stood too, while we sang the fearful song, the hymn of the guild, which apprentices must get by heart, but which is sung only on that one day of the year. Silent she stood too, while we knelt among the broken pews and prayed. Then Master Gerloes and Master Palaemon, aided by several of the older journeymen, began her legend. Sometimes one spoke alone, sometimes all chanted together, sometimes two spoke to different effect, while the others played flutes they had carved of thigh bones, or the three-stringed rebeck that shrieks like a man. When they reached that part of the narration at which our patroness is condemned by Maxentius, four masked journeymen rushed out to seize her. So silent and serene before, she resisted now, struggled and cried out. But as they bore her toward it, the wheel appeared to blur and change. In the light of the candles, it seemed at first that serpents, green pythons with jeweled heads of scarlet and citrine and white, writhed from it. Then it was seen that these were flowers, roses in the bud. When the maid was but a step away, they bloomed. They were of paper, concealed, as I well knew, within the segments of the wheel. Feigning fear, the journeymen drew back. But the narrators, Gerloes, Palaemon, and the others, speaking together as Maxentius, urged them on. Then I, still unmasked, and in the dress of an apprentice, stepped forward and said, "Resistance avails nothing. You are to be broken on the wheel, but we would do you no further indignity." The maid gave no answer but reached out and touched the wheel, which at once fell to pieces, collapsing with a clatter to the floor, all its roses gone. "Behead her," demanded Maxentius, and I took up the sword. It was very heavy. She knelt before me. "You are a counselor of omniscience," I said. "Though I must slay you, I beg you spare my life." For the first time the maid spoke, saying, "Strike and fear not." I lifted the sword. I remember that for a moment I feared it would overbalance me. When I think back on that time, it is that moment I recall first. To remember more, I must work, forward or backward from that. In memory, it seems to me, I stand always so, in gray shirt and ragged trousers, with the blade poised above my head. While I raised it, I was an apprentice. When it descended, I would be a journeyman of the Order of the Seekers for Truth and Penitence. It is our rule that the executioner must stand between his victim and the light. The maid's head lay in shadow on the block. I knew that the sword in falling would do her no harm. I would direct it to one side, tripping an ingenious mechanism that would elevate a wax head smeared with blood while the maid draped her own with a fuligin cloth. Still, I hesitated to give the blow. She spoke again from the floor at my feet, and her voice seemed to ring in my ears. Strike and fear not. With such strength as I was capable of, I sent the false blade down. For an instant, it seemed to me that it met resistance. Then it thudded into the block, which fell into two. The maid's head, all bloody, tumbled forward toward the watching brothers. Master Gerlose lifted it by the hair, and Master Palaemon cupped his left hand to receive the blood. "With this our chrism," he said, "I anoint you, Severian, our brother forever." His index finger traced the mark upon my forehead.
"So be it,"
said Master Gerlose, and all the journeymen save I. The maid stood. I knew, even as I watched her, that her head was only concealed in the cloth, but it seemed there was nothing there. I felt dizzy and tired. She took the wax head from Master Gerlose and pretended to replace it on her shoulders, slipping it by some sleight into the fulgent cloth, then standing before us radiant and whole. I knelt before her, and the others withdrew. She raised the sword with which I had so lately struck off her head. The blade was bloody now from some contact with the wax. "You are of the torturers," she said. I felt the sword touch either shoulder, and at once eager hands were drawing the head mask of the guild over my face and lifting me. Before I well knew what had occurred, I was on the shoulders of two journeymen. It was only afterward that I learned they were Draught and Roche, though I should have guessed it. They were bearing me up the processional aisle through the center of the chapel, while everyone cheered and shouted. We were no sooner outside than the fireworks began. Crackers about our feet and even around our ears. Torpedoes banging against the 1,000-year-old walls of the chapel. Rockets, red and yellow and green, leaping into the air. A gun from the great keep split the night. All the brave meats I have described were on the tables in the court. I sat at the head between Master Palaemon and Master Gerlose, and drank too much. Very little for me has always been too much, and was cheered and toasted. What became of the maid I do not know. She disappeared as she has each Catherine's day I can remember. I have not seen her again. How I reached my bed I have no notion. Those who drink much have told me that they sometimes forget all that befell them in the latter part of the night, and perhaps it was so with me. But I think it more likely that I, who never forget anything, who, if I may for once confess the truth, though I seem to boast, do not truly understand what others mean when they say forget, for it seems to me that all experience becomes a part of my being, only slept and was carried there. However it may be, I woke not in the familiar low room that was our dormitory, but in a cabin so small it was much higher than wide, a journeyman's cabin. And because I was the most junior of the journeymen, the least desirable in the tower, a portless cubbyhole no larger than a cell. My bed seemed to toss beneath me. I gripped the sides and sat up, and it was still, but as soon as my head touched the pillow, once more the swaying began again. I felt I was wide awake, then that I was awake again but had been sleeping only a moment before. I was conscious that someone was in the tiny cabin with me, and for some reason I could not have explained, I thought it was the young woman who had taken the part of our patroness. I sat up in the tossing bed. Dim light filtered beneath the door. There was no one there. When I lay down again, the room was filled with Thecla's perfume. The false Thecla from the House Azure had come then. I got out of bed and, nearly falling, opened the door. There was no one in the passage outside. A chamber pot waited beneath the bed, and I pulled it out and filled it with my spew. Rich meat swimming in wine mixed with bile. Somehow I felt what I had done was treason, as if by casting out all that the guild had given me that night, I had cast out the guild itself. Coughing and sobbing, I knelt beside the bed, and, at last, after wiping my mouth clean, lay down again. No doubt I slept. I saw the chapel, but it was not the ruin I knew. The roof was whole and high and straight, and from it there hung ruby lamps. The pews were whole and gleamed with polish. The ancient stone altar was swatched in cloth of gold. Behind the altar rose a wonderful mosaic of blue, but it was blank, as if a fragment of sky without cloud or star had been torn away and spread upon the curving wall. I walked toward it down the aisle, and as I did so, I was struck by how much lighter it was than the true sky, whose blue is nearly black, even on the brightest day. Yet how much more beautiful this was! It thrilled me to look at it. I felt I was floating in air, borne up by the beauty of it, looking down upon the altar, down into the cup of crimson wine, down upon showbread and antique knife. I smiled and woke. In my sleep I had heard footsteps in the passage outside, and I knew I had recognized them, though I could not just then recall whose steps they were. Struggling, I brought back the sound. It was no human tread, only the padding of soft feet, and an almost imperceptible scraping. I heard it again, so faint that for a time I thought I had confused my memory with reality, but it was real. Slowly coming up the passage, slowly going back. The mere lifting of my head brought a wave of nausea. I let it fall again, telling myself that whoever might pace back and forth, it was no affair of mine. The perfume had vanished, and sick though I was, I felt I needed to fear unreality no longer. I was back in the world of solid objects and plain light. My door opened a trifle, and Master Malrubius looked in, as though to make certain I was all right. I waved to him, and he shut the door again. It was some time before I recalled that he had died while I was still a boy.